This week, we welcome Patrick O'Reilly, co-founder and chief product officer at CyberSaint, to discuss transforming cyber risk and compliance through automation. In the leadership and communications section, Paul, Jason, and I share our lessons learned from 2020 and changes we see coming in 2021. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Week. DeepWatch provides innovative managed security services that empower organizations to be more resilient against today's evolving cyber threats. DeepWatch offers game-changing capabilities in managed detection and response, managed endpoint detection and response, and vulnerability management, all delivered through a unique squad model, a dedicated group of security experts that works directly with each client. From managed security operations to threat hunting to continuous measurement of security readiness, DeepWatch is advancing the service of managed security. Measure your SecOps maturity for free by visiting securityweekly.com/DeepWatch. Most breaches are caused by exploiting oversights in basic cybersecurity fundamentals, but complex hybrid multi-cloud infrastructures make cybersecurity hygiene challenging. Red Seal can help. It shows you what's on your network, how it's connected, and the associated risk across public cloud, private cloud, and physical environments. With Red Seal, you'll get control of your cybersecurity fundamentals so you can protect your organization from the inevitable attack vectors and reduce your cyber risk. For more information, visit securityweekly.com/Red Seal. As a security leader, CyberArray for Teams was built to make your job easier. Are you struggling to measure your team's skills proficiency, provide critical or relevant role-based training, or translate training investments into meaningful business outcomes? CyberArray for Teams is the industry's number one NIST-aligned DoD 8140 and 8570 compliance certification and skills training platform. 96% of the Fortune 500 have employees training on CyberArray. CyberArray for Teams, skills development solved. Visit cyberarray.it/solved to solve your training problems.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 200, recorded December 14th, 2020. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in a snowy Colorado. Joining me from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island is my first co-host, Mr. Paul Asadorian.
Thanks, Matt. It's good to be here on episode 200, where I now have the difference between Red Seal and Red Canary, which I messed up last week. I don't know if you caught that, Matt. It was really embarrassing, though. I feel like they both deserve a little more airtime. They are two totally different and totally awesome companies.
Yes, two very different solutions, companies. Paul. Yes. And joining us on the lines is my second co-host, Mr. Jason Albuquerque.
Hey, Matt. Hey, Paul. Great to be here. Episode 200, outstanding. When we come back from the new year, I'll be around 100 episodes, so I can't wait for that one. 201, baby.
Woohoo! There we go. Jason, you've been almost on as long as I have, Jason, so gotta watch out.
Aspirations, buddy, aspirations.
Yes. Do you always end up missing our live streams? Need somewhere to flag Security Weekly podcasts that you want to listen to? Subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher or our YouTube channel, sign up for our mailing list, and join our Discord server to stay in the loop on all things Security Weekly. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe. This segment is sponsored by CyberSaint. To learn more, please visit securityweekly.com/CyberSaintBSW. Patrick O'Reilly is Chief Product Officer and co-founder at CyberSaint, where he leads the product innovation and development for the company. His experience as a Harvard-trained economist, IT risk and compliance consultant, and his early exposure to cybersecurity led him to co-found CyberSaint and develop an award-winning patented platform used by some of the most recognizable companies in the world to automate cyber and IT risk and compliance management at scale. Patrick, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, I love this topic because some of the people know I spent a good portion of my career in governance, risk management, and compliance, having built one of the early platforms. And I want to give this little story because I think it's interesting to kind of the thought process behind CyberSaint. When we built GRC back in the day, I was running third-party vendor management for one of the top 10 banks in the country, and I had 70,000 vendors, and I had to run third-party vendor assessments across these 70,000 vendors, and it was Excel spreadsheets and email, and you know the story, right? And so we set out to build a system that could help us automate steps in the process, and we did. We built a product called Control Path and was in the space for a while. But there's one fundamental flaw I made in the early design of the platform. The assumption was only 20% or so of the controls that you have to assess are technical in nature. The rest were management and operational controls, and we used questionnaires to collect all the data.
Right.
But what that basic assumption did was really limited the scalability of the early GRC platforms, in that when you took that 20% of controls, but then you scaled it out to thousands or hundreds of thousands of assets, you ran into a pretty big technological challenge. That's where I want to start the conversation, Patrick, because you saw that somewhere in your history, which, you know, led to CyberSync, I think.
Yeah, it did. Because early days, we did start trying to just run controls on various assessments. And that's what we do. That's what the software started to do. That was the first version of the product. And quickly, we ran into the problem you're talking about, which is kind of, you know, more of a multi-tenancy. And how do you, you know, how do you treat controls over time? And how do you make it scalable? So we had to, you know, change the data model in the rebuild. And that's what we did. We tweaked the data model. And now a lot of what we're doing still relates to the problem you described, which is how do you get data into a multi-tenant environment with different tags, you know, different operating units, business units, applications, et cetera, and do that in a, you know, a granular way and configure those controls. So we don't want to ignore those technical controls. You know, we do have the questionnaire-based version inside system. We're flexible. So we have always built to be maximally flexible because we knew that the use cases were going to keep coming and they were going to be different. So we try to solve for, you know, the most use cases as possible.
Yeah, and it's the data model that I think is the interesting part you really had to focus some time on, because we had a lot of flexibility in a control path, but I was a MySQL backend. And I could only do so much in a relational database. Then you had somebody like Archer who built a metadata model on top of a SQL Server database. And you want to talk about limitation of scale. That was the best way to do it. So how did you solve like the basic fundamental data architecture to give you the flexibility you needed in the data model, in the design of how all these pieces come together, but also keep scale available? Because that's really the challenge.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm going to give some credit to my chief developer, Scott Shidlovsky, because he came in just after we changed the data model. And, you know, he wanted to get us on a more classical design. And I think what we have used metadata, you know, in fact, to classify assessments. So we really view things kind of, you know, hierarchically, like framework, assessment, controls, and the like. And we're going at both ends now with the data model. So, you know, we have to have ways to classify assessments, you know, because a lot of the companies we're working with, they're integrating into, like, say, Tenable, for example, they port data across tag structures, so group and type tag structures. It's very important to have that extensibility in the data model. And then at the bottom, you know, at the control level, it turns out that, you know, with integration into CMDBs, you have to allow controls to have configuration now. So they have to have, you know, effectively the capability to eat spreadsheets, controls, individual controls now. So it's, you know, we have a very flexible sort of fundamental theorem, and it's extensible from top to bottom.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the challenges in this space, because no two organizations have the same asset structure and no two organizations have the same control structure.
They don't. And you have to be sort of, you know, always doing a certain kind of mathematics to get, as mathematicians would say, the most general case.
Right, exactly right. So when we think about deployments, give us some ideas. Where do customers start? I mean, there is a journey to building out a governance, risk management, and compliance program, right?
Yeah.
So kind of walk us through, what does that look like for CyberSync customers? Where do they start? What are some of the big use cases where they're leveraging the automation you can bring to the table to solve some of their problems?
Yeah. Well, it starts with, you know, learning how they've done assessments historically, right? You know, they usually come to us after they've hit a brick wall of sorts, but there's a lot of good material there, you know? So they usually have some way of classifying their assets. They usually have some kind of cadence they've been on with respect to assessments. They usually have, you know, some audit requirements. They have frameworks, they have standards they use. So with the bigger customers, and I guess that would be, you know, because we work with a lot of the Fortune 500, they might start out with a couple of fundamental frameworks that they've taken and sort of maybe run into a bit of a brick wall in some legacy GRC. And what they really want to do is get moving with sort of, you know, the multi-tenant and then one pane of glass aspect of our platform very quickly. So they'll give us big frameworks they've been working for a long time. Some of them are very custom. So their data model had to adapt to that too, because companies that are mature often have, you know, a version of the CSF that might have, you know, two additional dimensions on the framework functions. It might have, you know, 40 additional subcategories. They might have a 900 control environment that they've mapped into the CSF. So, you know, showing them that we can quickly, you know, satisfy that. And then we start to build out the, you know, asset structure or the business org structure across it. One of the largest use cases we have, several thousand assessments, and it's all site-based. So we had to have, you know, the tag structure had to support, you know, we're in, you know, say Texas, and now we're in this county, and now we're at this kind of site, and, you know, we're looking at this kind of operation inside the site. So it's a cascading hierarchical thing. So, you know, I would say that, you know, I'm surprised at how quickly we get it done with some of the larger companies, because they do have some unique approaches to things. But we like to be able to support that if we can, because it gives them the confidence that we're going to be able to support their longer term goals as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, getting that asset structure in, mapping out the controls, two huge barriers for most organizations. I remember the days when I was at the bank, I used to have to go into the general ledger system just to pull like the business hierarchy, because it wasn't stored anywhere else except for finance had it in the GL, right?
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Yeah, we deal with the same basic issues. And the thing is, you don't want it's a real opportunity, because this is where the legacy platforms fall down a bit. So, you know, if we can solve these things in a nimble way, we have a very good opportunity to keep working with these organizations, which is exciting.
Yeah. Now let's talk. I heard a question back there. I'm going to stop.
I was just going to kind of throw in there. I mean, from an organization like ours, we not only have our internal control sets that we need to make sure we're adhering to, we have 6,000 customers, right? So at the end of the day, as a managed service provider, IT services organization, our customers want to know from their vendor risk management perspective that we're adhering to their authority documents. So, you know, we have a central pillar of NIST 853, but we try to map back 19 different authority documents for our customers us to be able to show adherence to their control sets as a service provider, right? So that's a place that, you know, can be a struggle sometimes. I'm interested in hearing on how, you know, you can, in that multi-tenant environment that you're mentioning, how you can architect something like that for us, right? It's not necessarily our internal operational requirements, but it's something that we have to show our customers.
Yeah, you've got to report out on some standard that you're using 853. Good choice, by the way. You know, it's the deepest pool, I think. And if you are going to start propagating data into other environments and other regulatory structures and controls, 853 is excellent for that, because it's so granular. We've solved that in a lot of different ways over time. At first, it was iterative. At first, it was crosswalking between standards that were related. So like, say, DFARS or Handbook 162 and, NIST 853, you know, sort of parent-child relations. Mm-hmm. So in our data model, yet again to reference our data model, we associate controls and control IDs and control actions with each other. So I think, you know, the way we're solving it now is we actually have, you know, researchers on staff along with me who are, you know, building natural language processing to do much more granular analysis of some of these mappings. So if you look at a classic mapping like 853 into the sys controls and the sys subcontrols, it's not that granular. It's sort of like, you know, it's like if you use the analogy of GPS, it would be like you're pointing at a county and not a house, right? If you actually look at a control like AC2, it's got 16 line items on it, right? Well, where do all those line items go into the sys controls, onto the subcontrols? Those mappings don't really exist. That's what we're trying to solve now. So we've built some algorithms to solve that. That said, we do crosswalking all the time behind the scenes, and now we're building out the UI around crosswalking so that teams can stop having to maybe run to the UCF, that huge paywall that's put up around it in the authority documents. We're trying to solve this at scale in a more exact, precise way, leveraging NLP, because it's really a candidate problem for NLP.
Yeah.
And large organizations are coming to us on this. They're like, we've got this crazy control set that we've used for years, and we don't even know how it projects across these 20 regulations. So, you know, this is a huge opportunity to do this.
Patrick, yeah. I had a question, just more of a basic question, right? Obviously, Matt and Jason spend a lot more time in this area than I do, for sure. Where does the baseline come from, right? What I hear you talking about collectively is that, you know, we like to have a baseline that we compare to different compliance standards. Maybe some of those are our own internal standards that we've set. Some of them are external standards that we have to be in compliance to or want to be in compliance to. Obviously, there's a difference. Where do most of your customers get that baseline from? I'm assuming it's a combination of things, right?
Yeah, it depends on the sector. You know, so like, for example, the energy, you know, sector, you know, they're old and mature, and they're really protecting against certain types of terrible attacks. So they have the government watching them, right? Mm-hmm. So they have NERC-SIP they're working with. They often work with the big four. So they might be running a version of the cybersecurity framework that's diagnostic. They might have their own internal IT controls as well. But then you look at other industries like education, that's more, you know, they're pulling some of these standards out of best practices, you know, so they've read up on NIST and they want to get compliant on NIST 853 and it's sort of an in-house project. Banking, totally different. Banking's got to be compliant with Office of the Comptroller, the SEC, certain Chinese regulations, it goes on and on the list. You know, one of the best of practice approaches for baselining yourself is to do what Matt was talking about, which is to grab 853, mm-hmm. baseline yourself on that. And there's a lot of, efficiencies you can get out of 853 into other control environments.
Patrick, where do the data sources come to see if you're compliant with those? Are they questionnaires primarily? Is it scan data combination?
It's a combination. Mm. So, with the vision with automation that we're working on now is you could pull in data from all sorts of your whole stack. You could pull it in from your identity and access management system. You could pull it in from your, you know, global policy objects. You could pull it in from your vulnerability scan, you know, behavioral analytics, and the list goes on and on. So the real, you know, pie in the sky vision that we have is you and we're doing it now, is to pull actual data in onto controls and automate the controls where you can, and then have the human review where you still need it, which you will in some spots. Like, do you have, you know, logs for people visiting your facilities? Do you have desks? You know, do you have key card stuff? There's certain answers, you know, you can't automate unless you can, you know, reach into someone's head, which is not quite yet possible.
How often are folks iterating on that automation?
You know, automation, I think in our space was, something that was talked about in 2018 to some extent, and COVID has really sort of forced the larger companies' hands a little bit on it, because the workforce is virtualizing and they're moving to the cloud, and they see an opportunity now to pull data in a more automated manner. Mm. And I think automation was always the dream. You had companies claiming 4 or 5 years ago that they were going to automate control assessments. Turns out they couldn't quite pull it off. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't in their wheelhouse. So some of the companies that initially claimed to do automation weren't really interested in diving into the controls and establishing how does this kind of identity and access management data map specifically to controls and components of controls. It's a bit of work. We got into it because we were interested in taking vulnerability data and threat data and mapping to controls. So that's how we started. So, you know, now it's much more possible because, you know, it's the time is right and companies are willing to invest the time in it.
I think it's so important though, because like, I want to know, all right, we've created a policy that says we will have multi-factor authentication. And like one day we don't. And I mean, that control can fall off in a number of different ways, but also how you test for that, maybe that's not your vulnerability scanner in my experience, right? That's something else. How do we keep tabs on stuff like that? Like once we've set policy, especially compliance policy, I want to know if we're out of compliance. That's a huge issue.
Huge. Yeah, agreed. And you know, we're doing a lot of that right now. So
gotcha. Sorry, Matt.
Yeah. Just to explain how not simple his statement was, I did this for 5.5 years, right? Yeah. I mean, to say that I can pull in vulnerability scan results is no small task.
No.
Some of the scale, I think people need to understand. Yeah. I remember when we were doing the due diligence when we got acquired by TrustWave, Qualys was the other acquirer. And I remember Philippe and the team coming in and say, okay, how do you render 500,000 assets? That was like a really interesting question. And I saw Sean Malloy's head just spinning like, okay, I can do it. Right. And he would do it. But it's not just that. It's 500,000 assets. Now tie 100+ vulnerabilities to every single one of those assets and do the math. We're talking billions of records that need to be correlated in these systems. And so this was always the challenge, Patrick, right? I mean, how do you bring in billions of records and be able to run them through these various checks and roll them back up to your control standards, see if you're in compliance or not? That is no small task.
No, it's not. It's not. And if it weren't for having, you know, some NLP, we wouldn't be able to look at the more dynamic data that's coming out of vulnerability assessments. So, you know, the full dream of, you know, having every asset associated with its unique controls and then having vulnerability data spreading across it is, you know, it's a very large challenge because there's a lot of logic involved. And, we've had to put our thinking caps on occasion.
Yeah.
And now, guys, couple that with all the information you need to collect from the bane of my existence, which I'll call vendor risk management. Oh, yeah. Right? Cool. I mean, that's a whole other piece that you know, we have to manage on our side, our hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of vendors, where, you know, ultimately someday I see the nirvana of my cyber saint tenant and their cyber saint tenant. Having some level of API connection or connectivity where they could feed me the information so I don't have to go through these arduous assessments.
Yes. Yeah. And vendor risk management has come on our radar, especially, this year. So, you know, a lot of the companies we're working with that are, you know, part of the onboarding process is they're also spinning up a vendor risk management program at the same time. And they like Arc product because it's so intuitive. So when they, you know, ask their vendors to answer questionnaires, they like to leverage us because it's very simple. They can just come in, be, you know, located on the specific assessment that they're assigned to, do the work, and you have the visibility. Reporting out on your vendor risk as well, we're trying to make that as simple as possible.
Yeah, I mean, your scale there, Jason, is 6,000 vendors, you know, 1,200 questions on a standard information gathering form, potentially.
Yeah. I mean, if they even understand what we do, right? I mean, that's the problem is in many cases, customers come at us with the highest risk assessment possible because they don't quite understand that as a managed service provider, we're not processing their data. Right. We're not storing their data, things of that nature. So I think part of the issue is, and I found that with my team, we're better off having a conversation before they even send us the assessment so they can better understand what we do so they can limit the scope.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Patrick, we got all this data, right? We got our assets in, we got our controls in, we're starting to do some automation on the control validation. How does this then roll up to the business, to the board of directors? How is risk being delivered on a more real-time basis? Because I think that's the nirvana state, right?
Is
if I can automate the collection of this data, I can see changes in risk in a real-time way and be able to educate the executives and the board.
Exactly. And that is really the nirvana or the holy grail or whatever you want to call it. We started out running risk assessments that were very simple. They were 853. They were 830 based, out of NIST. So they leveraged, likelihood and impact. And they were at the level of control failure for a while because our first clients were just sort of running control environments and their risk assessments were just based on the control sets. We had to pivot and build in a risk register because our largest clients were saying, hey, how do we have the conversation in the boardroom? I don't want to be on a control. I don't want to look at the control data. We don't want to be surfing through the, terabytes of data or whatever and look at it. We don't really even want to hear much IT language. What we want to hear about is return on investment and, CapEx and OpEx. And we want to look at gaps and we want to analyze what to do. And we want to be able to look across different classifications of our business units or our assets and see patterns as well, and then make decisions based on those patterns. So that was what we had to solve. And we, early last year, we got the new risk register into the platform. We got what we call solution cost modeling into the platform as well, which is the ability to identify gaps, do the analytics across different, however you slice and dice your assets or risks or applications or sites, and then actually game out solutions for it using costing. So we try to be as flexible as possible. We have 830 as a risk model. We have a simple risk model. We have the FAIR model coming. So we want to be risk model agnostic, but we're inside some of those conversations in the boardroom and we take it seriously. We want to arm security professionals with the best data and the best presentation of data that they can have possible to make the case upstairs, because there are two cultures. There are more than two cultures, but, when you're talking about the board or the C-suite talking to the security team, you have to bridge the gap. And, the metrics are generally dollars and years. And so you have to get security data in. It's got to be, it's got to be good. And if you're automating, it's all live. And so when you are talking dollars, you're talking dollars on a day-to-day basis. And the senior management tends to like that.
Yeah, and that's the gap in the current GRCs. Back to Paul's original question, like the frequency. Paul, we used to do these like once a year.
Mm.
We're talking like now you can pull in results, even on a daily basis, would be like leaps ahead of where the industry has traditionally been in an annual type of assessment.
That's right. Yeah, and getting that, that data in, fresh is really more and more organizations want to do it that way now.
Yeah. And I can tell you it's super impactful sitting in front of a group of senior executives or a board of directors when you can say, when you're presented with a question and you can say, as of this morning, here is the answer. Or, hey, wait a minute, and you check your mobile device and say, here's the answer as of 1 minute ago.
Right. It is much more powerful. And, just the data validity and the data quality, it's when you're dealing with an assessment that's 6 months old and you're, trying to make decisions based on it, no one's very comfortable.
Yeah, no one's comfortable. And look, the environment that we live in today, stuff is changing so fast. We can't be relying on even three-month-old data, let alone, annual data. I mean, think about all the changes that have happened in the last 8-9 months. Mm-hmm. And think about all the risk changes and impacts that every business has had to face. Real time has to be the way to go in this space.
It has to. And the time really is now for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, Jason, any more questions for Patrick while we have him? I could go on all day, but I also want to make sure we stay on time.
This could be a half a day exercise here, but no, awesome stuff. Love it, Patrick. I'm liking what I'm hearing from CyberSaint.
Yeah, good stuff. Thank you, Patrick.
Much. Thanks for having me.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly. To learn more about automating your cyber risk and compliance, please visit securityweekly.com/cybersaintbsw. We're going to take a quick break and then cover our lessons learned in 2020.
With over half of enterprise security budgets going towards detection and response in 2020, the challenge is investing in solutions that can migrate and scale with your business. ExtraHop helps security teams spot threats up to 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently in hybrid and multi-cloud environments with cloud-native network detection and response. Kick the tires in the full product demo at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. The most at-risk industries like financial, tech, and government agencies use web isolation to keep their networks and users secure. The Silo Web Isolation platform by Authenticate allows users to experience the web in full isolation, eliminating the chance of a web-borne cyber attack. You can interact with malicious files and websites without worry, even if you're working remotely. Authenticate enables anyone, anywhere, on any device to experience the web without risk. See how it works at securityweekly.com/authenticate. Cyber risk and compliance automation is finally here. Arduous legacy GRC systems cannot support the powerful real-time automation and oversight that organizations require to take risks that matter and compete in today's business climate. CyberSaint ingests data from your existing tech stack to deliver unprecedented patented automation and visibility into enterprise risk and compliance. Don't get left behind. See why the most forward-thinking CISOs and business leaders of Fortune 500 and more partner with CyberSaint. Maximize your cybersecurity program today by visiting securityweekly.com/CyberSaintBSW.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian and Jason Albuquerque. Do you have a specific guest or topic that you want us to cover on one of the shows? Submit your suggestions for guests by visiting securityweekly.com/guests and completing the form. We review suggestions monthly and will reach out to you once reviewed. We're also getting ready for the 2021 interview schedule, so they'll come soon. Also, in our final technical training of 2020, our friends from Vulcan Cyber will show you how to move beyond vulnerability scan to vulnerability fix. Visit securityweekly.com/webcast to register, or visit securityweekly.com/on-demand to view all of our previously recorded webcasts. We did a ton of webcasts and technical trainings this year. Lots of good content and data out there. All right, gentlemen. So as you guys know, usually on the weekend, I go to Feedly and I start looking at all my different article feeds and like, okay, which article should we cover for the show? And I'm looking at all these articles. I'm like, yeah, we covered that. We covered that. Yep, we covered that. Okay, yep, that's the same. And I said, why don't we just riff on, look, we've been covering the news for all of 2020. We're one of the, you know, I think what was interesting about 2020 for us is there was no hiccup in our schedules. We kept recording. We were already set up for virtual. And so we've covered a lot of news in the year 2020. And I thought it would be kind of interesting for us to just like, what were our lessons learned? What did we learn in 2020? And what are the things we have to really think about from a leadership and communication perspective when we move into 2021?
Yeah, Matt, you know, first of all, it just shows you how humans can be a creature of habit, right? Because, you know, my habit is, you know, get up first thing, check to see what articles are going to be in the afternoon. And, you know, I spend my day refresh, no articles, refresh, no articles, refresh, no articles. Then I finally look at the description of the show and I'm like, all right, I get it now.
I did the same thing.
Which is awesome. I love it.
I get this whole brand new.
It shows you creature of habit, right?
Right. I got this whole brand new computer we built for this set in the studio for webcasts and for doing shows. And I'm on the page and I'm like, I'm going to put my articles up on this big screen. So I have, I'm like, there's no articles for me to test my new setup. Damn it.
I messed you both up today.
You did.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't know what it was awesome because when I saw the description, it kind of made me think back and go through all of the previous shows, right? And it's kind of funny when I started trending out the articles for all the shows. I started in January, February timeframe, and you know it was normal leadership trends, leadership books, and then you start getting into March, and we're talking about leadership in times of crisis and recession scenarios. And then you start going into like April in the summer time frame, and it's like, productivity and CISO burnout and acceleration of digital transformation and how to handle that. So it just, I mean, it shows you what a roller coaster of a year as you start going through week by week, all those articles we were covering.
Yeah. What I think is interesting is there's some trends that are going to stick with us for a while. And yeah. one of the takeaways for me, as I've been doing 2021 business planning, for example, right? There's a lot of questions being asked about cost structures. Revenue is interesting, right? I mean, there's definitely discussions about revenue growth and revenue, but there's also this cautionary tale behind cost structures and amortizing costs in 2021. Because let's say that we continue a roller coaster year, Jason, and we don't hit all of our revenue targets, then the cost line becomes a very impactful component to the business. And I don't know that we've talked a ton about it on the show, but I'm realizing that what you're going to see as organizations continue to finalize their budgets this year into 2021, people are going to look at how do we keep our costs low, because we want to see how revenue is going to tick up or not tick up as we get into 2021. Nobody wants to make big bets when there's a big cost component under the covers right now.
Well, 100%. I mean, as executives, we're going to be exposed more and more to operational performance metrics like EBITDA, right? Those are the conversations we're going to be having because again, you know, we're in a place where organizations aren't going to want to take a lot of risk financially, right? So making sure we're curbing costs as much as we possibly can while still trying to drive revenue into the organization, you'll hear my CFO talk about playing offense and playing defense, much like a football team, which is kind of amazing to hear the references, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Offense, go out and drive top line revenue, but on the defensive side, make sure we're doing the right things from a cost structure to protect ourselves so that we don't end up in a situation where we go out of business in 2021.
That's it. It's right now it's about savings, right? It's about making sure you have some money in the bank, some cash in the bank. So that way you can operate with some level of insurance just in case things go sideways again.
Yeah, and I think we saw some of this in a lot of the funding announcements and news that we've seen over the past few months. You see some of these organizations going out raising additional capital, so they have it in the bank, Jason, right? So they can survive potentially another rainy year if that's what we have. Now, hopefully, look, the insight we're getting from the industry and from other people, we think the second half of the year, things start to open back up. We start to get back to some level of potentially on-premise physical events, and we start to get back to some level of normalcy. But look, we're going to be in this kind of remote hybrid environment, I think, for a good course, if not all of 2021.
We'll talk about it more on Wednesday in how we structure our security programs to handle what is, I believe, to come in 2021. Is that you've really got three different groups of people and how they work. And you're going to have a kind of shifting percentage of your workforce that are working from home 100% of the time. You're going to have this middle group that's going to fluctuate work from home, office, maybe shared workspaces, right? That's going to be tricky to provide security. Yeah. Then you're going to have a percentage going to go back to work. Look, there are many of us working from our kitchen tables at home with trying to distance learn our children at the same time. And that is not the ideal scenario for, I think, a third of the workforce is my prediction, right? So I think moving into 2021, as vaccines become more available, things start to open up a little bit, we're going to have to secure our organizations now in these three different areas, which is going to prove to be almost as challenging, if not as challenging, as everyone going to work from home all at once. At least that was a known thing. Like, okay, there's no one in the office. Everyone's working from home. Let's put our strategy around that. Now we're going to have to be really dynamic and even more fluid than we were this year.
At the end of the day, Paul, it's a work from anywhere strategy.
Yep.
That's what we need to be thinking about, work from anywhere.
Right. And we got to think about what are the different types of programs, what are the different types of processes, what are the different types of tools we're going to put in place that manages that work from anywhere scenario, on-prem, home, or wherever.
And it's people, process, and technology. And you know what I found is that all those things have a cost associated with them. there's a cost to, I want to develop a new process. There's a cost to doing that to the business. I want to add people, train people, have people embody a different culture or build my culture. There's a cost to that. And of course, technology, as we all know, has that hard bottom line. Jason, you mentioned EBITDA. We've heard that term a lot. This year, and that's really about what types of costs are we going to incur? And technology can hit a lot of those different
100%. Buckets. Yeah, the other side too is folks should realize that we're buying and receiving revenue in a different fashion. Mm. So my organization, for example, as an IT service provider, implementations were a big piece of revenue. Well, guess what? All of that cost for on-prem hardware assets, that type of stuff, is all moved to subscription now. So we're actually receiving revenue differently than we used to, right? Now it's going over the period of a three-year contract, monthly payments. So our ability to spend like we used to is completely different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We saw the same thing on the virtual event side for CyberRisk Alliance as a whole, right? We moved away from a physical event that has a lot of costs associated with it, right? Because you're renting a facility, food, all the stuff, to a virtual platform where you don't have the same cost, but you're delivering it in a completely different way, right? And so you've seen shifts in business models in 2020 that I think are still very relevant in 2021. You might see a physical event come back, but in our case, you're also going to see a lot of virtual activities continue well into 2021 and maybe around for way longer than that as a delivery mechanism, because we're seeing some very interesting data starting to come out on the other side, right? Of the sponge, the learners love the virtual formats because they don't have to justify travel budget, being out of the office, et cetera. They can get their content, their learning content in this new virtual platform. They love it. But when you move to the executives, Jason, they miss the collaboration and the ability to sit down face to face and communicate with people. So you've seen the shift even in our industry of the pros and the cons of virtual versus non-virtual activities.
100%. But at the end of the day, it allows organizations to be that much more precise in how they're architecting their content, right? Because right now it's going to be all about the metrics, what was successful and what wasn't. And the things that are successful and they're driving the same amount of revenue or maybe more because more people enjoy the platform better, you're going to start to see all of that shift to virtual, right? I mean, at the end of the day, why would you want to spend so much money on in-person if you're getting the same success rates or better success rates with virtual? But then on the other side, you may have to go back to some of those normal activities for the events that weren't as successful and didn't have as good of an impact, right? And you need to have that in person, like CISO type events or CIO type events.
But we've also adopted a lot, I think a lot more technologies, a lot more SaaS and cloud technologies to pull off 2020. I think every business had to adopt some new technology, at least one piece of new technology you had to adopt, whether it was spinning up a new social media presence to advertise your business because now you're a takeout restaurant versus, come and sit in the restaurant and have a meal, all the way up to enterprise. They're like, oh my God, everyone's working from home. How do we all collaborate?
Yeah.
I mean, we use, depending on who we're meeting with, Google Meet, Teams, RingCentral, Zoom, Skype, I mean, the whole gamut. Like, I have all that software available on my various computers. But now think about how the attack surface has maybe grown, but also changed. And attackers are taking advantage. I mean, it was the Treasury Department was just hacked because of some, Microsoft 365 vulnerability. So we've got some really hard and very new security challenges that haven't been fully unpacked yet that we're going to have
big time. I mean, at the end of the day, guys, digital transformation was an actual thing because organizations who didn't have much of a presence with digital economy were forced into it.
Yep.
And then organizations who already were, technical in nature and out there for their customers had to innovate and move forward anyway. So, we talked about this over the course of the last 6, 7, 8 months that it literally, the pandemic fast-tracked people's project timelines by years.
And how do you get a handle on what you have today? That's, I think, one of my biggest concerns is how do I know where all my assets are, what SaaS services we're using, how we use them, what's the policy? And that's just the first part of it. How do I enforce that and keep enforcing that to make changes? And who on the team is responsible for that, because that's a vulnerability management problem 101. Sure, I can go find a whole bunch of vulnerabilities, but if I don't get them to the right people, or those people don't exist to fix them, then I'm in a world of hurt.
Yeah, and it just shows the importance of having security teams within your organization. It's amazing how many times I find that organizations still don't have dedicated security teams, right? It's still, you know, and no knock to it, you know, an infrastructure-based function of IT, right? Where, you know, we all know that it needs to be more mature than that. But it's amazing to see folks who still have, you know, just that infrastructure-based security still there.
What do we see? Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the workforce changes a little bit, right? Because I think we know this model is going to happen where some people stay home, some people are on and off. I also assume we're going to see smaller offices, fewer offices. I mean, you don't, if a portion of your environment is going to stay remote, that's going to have a major impact on your physical building cost structures in 2021 as well, too, won't it?
Oh, 100%. You're going to start seeing cost analysis on, does the expenditure of this office warrant its existence? Are we driving enough revenue in this area of the country to warrant an office? Because, you know, sheer brick and mortar presence doesn't matter anymore. It really doesn't. You know, back in the day, you know, you used to have customers who'd say, I need you to have a physical office in this location if I'm going to do business with you. That's gone. Those days are gone.
That's the downside. But the upside now is I can go find talent anywhere.
Anywhere.
Potentially in the world. Not just the country. Right. I can find talent anywhere in the world.
Oh, yeah. 100%. I mean, it opens the door now for us to be able to bring talent in from anywhere and everywhere. That's the beauty of the situation, because executives are now getting more and more comfortable with the remote workforce. Some of the most restrictive organizations that we knew as far as remote work and allowing remote workforce, they're now open their doors to it because they had to. And now they realize the benefit of it.
Yeah, but Jason, you're not likely to shut down your physical facility altogether and tell everyone they're going to work from home from now on.
No. Again, the whole point is strategic, right? Mm-hmm. So it's what regions of the United States make sense for us to have a physical presence, right? Meaning brick and mortar facility versus having a remote workforce in that area, right? So it's right. Really about the strategy. It's the return on the investment for that brick and mortar building or the lease or whatever the case may be.
I foresee you creating like an accelerator space within your physical building to cut down your footprint more. Sure. So, right? You're probably not going to shut down the whole building, but if you're like, yeah, get this couple thousand square feet. I've seen your building. It's massive. This couple thousand square feet, yeah, maybe we want to rent it to a bunch of other people who need smaller offices or a rotating office, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen organizations who have three floors within a building, right? Mm. And now they're renting out the third floor.
Yeah.
Right? They're renting it out to other organizations.
GTEC here locally in Rhode Island did that early on. They were like making this big deal. We're going to have a big building in downtown Providence, right? Largely, it was occupied by other businesses, not the lottery company. Yeah. And that was way before COVID.
Yeah. Well, they were prepared for aspects of what they didn't know was coming, right? Which was this big shift. And I think you've got a lot of, especially in the tech space, big buildings with lots of floors that are just empty.
Mm-hmm. Especially there's going to be some big buildings in Silicon Valley that are going to be empty because Oracle and HP moved to Texas. That's
right. Yeah. Well, and Tesla is too.
And Tesla is too. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, Texas is going to get a little bit of a boom. Again, back to my comment, you can now go find talent anywhere. You don't have to be in a physical office in the Bay Area anymore in this environment. You don't have to be. And remember how many startups, Paul, wanted you in the Bay Area, in those environments, and those environments are just, virtualized now.
Texas also has a kind of smattering of that as well, and a history of that. Halt and Catch Fire was a TV show that popularized some of that. You know, Austin certainly a very high tech city, so I think it was a logical kind of step. Because I mean, quite frankly, some of the regulations that come out in California are not friendly to businesses, and that's one reason why they're leaving.
Yeah,
Well, you want to talk about EBITDA.
And the costs, yes.
The cost of taxes and the overhead and all the things.
Yep.
You know, we didn't talk about the person overhead. You know, we were talking people, process, technology. Guys, when you do a budget and you look at the cost of employees and benefits and everything else, it's like the biggest line item, mm-hmm. right? And yep, when you always can take that headcount out of a high tax area mm-hmm. and put it into a low tax area, there is bottom line dollar savings right there.
My father-in-law calls that Drano,
yeah.
which is high taxes, right? Why are you throwing it down the drain? So to be smart about strategies with where you're employing folks from, where you have your physical buildings, those tax implications, those are all major pieces of a strategy you have to think about, because
even vacation
time can turn into millions and millions of dollars.
In California, there's laws about vacation time that hit your bottom line, right? I mean, so much so that a lot of companies in Silicon Valley don't, like, there's no official vacation time policy, because if someone leaves, they're required to pay that out. But when you're paying people much higher salaries in these big mm-hmm. tech companies, that's a huge cost. So it's all a trickling effect. But
yeah,
you know, back to if people can work from anywhere, I think that's a strategy that will be employed.
Yeah,
do I have to have an office in Silicon Valley, right?
No, right.
Probably not.
Yeah, when I was at Layered Insight, I had unlimited vacation time, Paul.
Yep.
I didn't take any of it. And for that exact reason is because if you accrued it, you had to pay it out. Nobody wanted mm-hmm. that liability, so they stopped giving out PTO. Yeah. I mean, these are all things that impact our industry. And as we think about leaders, these are things we have to be cognizant of, because they potentially impact the way we have to build strategy going forward in 2021 and beyond about where employees are, how employees are paid, the whole remote anywhere stuff. I mean, these are all things that can impact some of those bottom line discussions we've been having.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, think of it this way, right? Where cost of living comes into play, because you could have two candidates that are exactly the same talent on paper when you assess them, but then you look at the cost of living in the salary dependencies that you have. You have somebody living in New York City mm-hmm. who you have to pay top wage, right? Or you have somebody out in maybe the Midwest or whatever, where maybe you can get away with a $20,000, $30,000 less in salary because it's the equivalent out there. You know what I mean? It's basically they're making an equivalent salary based on where they are.
Yeah, for sure. Before we wrap up this segment, I'm going to ask this question to both of you, and I'll give you my response as well. What's the big surprise we should be thinking about in 2021?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, I don't necessarily consider it a surprise, but I would say my prediction is we're going to see one hell of an uptick, and that's the visibility in state-sponsored attacks. I mean, I look at the environment that we're in right now, politically as a country, and some of the attacks that are already happening. I think some countries who are not necessarily friendly with us are just going to start ramping it up big time coming into the new year.
I think it's that the techniques that largely are employed only by state, or what we believe are nation state sponsored attacks, are going to trickle down into other groups that are not part of nation state attacks. And basically, if your house isn't in order, you're going to get popped.
Well, 100%. I agree. And that's kind of what I was leading into, because we're already starting to see the private sector getting nailed, right?
Yep.
Big time for that level of insight into their customers, into their government contracts, into their intellectual property. So yeah, I see that ramping up into the new year big time.
Which is good and bad. It gives us more visibility. But the question is, we got to do something with that visibility to do something about it. I would love to see some moves in more around security and maybe some privacy stuff. We'll see if we get there this year. I'm not quite sure. I'd love to see it. I mean, we're seeing a lot of discussions around the big tech companies and how they're using data. It's 2021 and being remote and having all these new like SaaS-based systems where a lot of our data is stored. Is this the year we start to make some progress on data privacy? I don't know. I'd like to see it, but we'll see.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, it's one of those scenarios where I hope, and again, you know, we have Congressman Langevin, luckily here in Rhode Island, who chairs the Cybersecurity Caucus in D.C. I'm glad to hear that, you know, he got elected again. I would love to see something nationally come out of that cyber solarium commission that was put together. You know, a lot of the recommendations they had didn't really move fast in this past administration, if they moved at all. But I think what I've heard is that pop back up.
Jason, I heard COVID kind of slowed that process down of getting things done, which is unfortunate. I think there's a huge opportunity. And I listened to some of our diversity segments that we did, and what's his name? Philip Niedermeyer is one of the chairs of the commissions and works very closely with a lot of those organizations that's trying to push cybersecurity into our education system.
Yeah,
I think one of the interesting things is, you know, if you're going to college, let's say, and you're distance learning, it becomes more accessible. And now universities and colleges have more of a presence in distance learning. It could become more accessible and actually help that problem, you know, moving forward. On the flip side, COVID kind of did slow down some of those initiatives. Hopefully we can pick those back up in 2021.
Yeah. No, I agree. I still think we have a responsibility to help build that pipeline, right? Mm-hmm. Because we can have all the best programs in the world, but if we don't have any students interested in taking part in those programs, we don't have a pipeline of workforce, right? So I think us in the industry still have a responsibility to identify kids in high school, maybe even middle school. I've always said that, right? Mm-hmm. On the aptitude and start guiding them the right way into cybersecurity as a career path.
And it's interesting, as I listen to some of our segments we've done on diversity, I think it's interesting to compare us to the medical field and to healthcare. I know the Gulas are really big on data care, and I got a chance to speak with them on the subject as well. What I find is interesting, I think one of the major problems is that people that would go into cybersecurity, everyone thinks you got to be a doctor to be in, and that's not true. You don't necessarily have to be a doctor. We need the equivalent of nurses and physician's assistants and every other role that's not a doctor when you walk into any medical facility that's there. We have a similar structure in cybersecurity. Sure, we need doctors, right? We need people who can do reverse engineering and write software and need a really, really large amount of skill and training and knowledge. But we also need the full spectrum of people to work in cybersecurity. Not everyone needs to be a doctor. Well, and I think that's something we need to evangelize as an industry, that if you want to get into the medical field, you don't necessarily need to be a doctor. You know, my wife's an example. She's a sonographer. It's a very technical field. But she didn't have to go to school for 14 years to be a doctor. But she's still in the medical profession helping people and accomplishing the mission. I think we can do the same thing in cybersecurity.
It's so funny, Paul. I literally just had this conversation with a principal of a middle school here in Rhode Island yesterday. And one of the things I said to him was, we need the equivalent for in IT of the old school vocational programs, because you want to know what? We need the electricians. We need the plumbers. Right. We need those entry-level IT peeps. And in many instances, I'm starting to notice that you don't necessarily have to have the 4-year degree to get your foot in the door into IT, right? It's attitude, aptitude, the ability to learn, certifications, getting them on a career path. And there may be some kids who weren't geared for college who could be incredible in IT.
Absolutely.
And hey, by the way, after some grooming, incredible in security.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we got to start early. We did the diversity panel on Enterprise Security Weekly a couple of weeks ago, middle school is almost too late, right? We got to think about this in grade schools, through the middle school, because they're making decisions. These kids are ruling things out at an earlier and earlier age. So we got to figure out how to bring some of this visibility back into even the grade schools, I think. And if we had programs and we had courses that would allow that, and people go, oh, wow, I really like this, because that's how I got into computers. It was basic programming classes back in middle school that turned me onto computers. You know, we gotta continue that kind of stuff.
It is, and it's identifying the aptitude as soon as we can. I mean, I've told my story here, right? All through high school, I thought I was going to be a police officer until I took the ASVAB test, and my recruiter said, "What the hell are you doing joining the military, kid? Do you know you have this aptitude for technology? You're going to technology school."
Right.
Yeah.
But and I think
always
that was
knew Mandy, I had that technology.
I think it was Mandy's point or someone's point on one of the panels was that, if you're considering going into the military or government service, you may want to consider getting to cybersecurity, because there's a lot of parallels there, right? Helping people and helping secure our infrastructure and things like that.
100%.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining me today. This is our last show of the year, so I wish everyone a happy holiday season, and we'll see you next year on Business Security Weekly.